When it comes to biohacking and pharmacological interventions, I always tell people, first look at a map of the human endocrine system, which looks like the New York subway system on acid, right? Whoa. Like, and trying to say input A is going to produce output B way down at the bottom of the chain is ridiculous under most circumstances. The only three nutraceuticals or, right, that ever work are caffeine, nicotine, and marijuana, because demon, we evolved with them.
This is an intro. Intro, intro, intro.
Hustle and flowchart with your boy, my boy, Matt Wolf, Joe Fair.
Hey, welcome back. We are getting to the end of January, and this whole month we've been replaying some of the most impactful episodes on our business and our lives. Today's is no different. This is the second to last episode we're doing this with. Starting next month, we're going to get back to semi-normal. I'll kind of talk about some of the changes we're making at the end of this episode and fill you in there. But this episode that you're about to listen to was hugely impactful. It was somebody that Joe and I are ultra grateful that we got to sit down and have a conversation with. He is a true thought leader, a true brilliant mind. Today's episode is Stephen Kotler, and we cover a lot of ground in this episode, stuff that's really, really relevant to where we are today. We, in the beginning, we're talking a little bit about this COVID world and where technology is going and the exponential technology that's being created and what the world looks like post-COVID, and even some of the concerns that we have about the new technology and new innovations that have come up during COVID. We also talk a lot about flow state. Stephen's life work has essentially been in how to get into flow states and what flow states are actually. So we really, really cover a lot of ground in flow states. We're going to talk about what a flow state is, what's happening in your body during a flow state, how to get into flow states. We're going to talk about some biohacking concepts. We're going to talk about what activities you should focus on getting into flow with, because certain activities you don't really even want to focus on getting into flow with. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about how to turn on the creativity in your brain when you need to get into a creative mode. What are some exercises you can do to flip that switch and get into a creative mode? We're going to talk about plant medicines and actually how to use them as nootropics. I'm talking marijuana. I'm talking tobacco. I'm talking mushrooms. We actually bring some of those topics up and talk about how those can be used as tools in your life. Wait till you hear his concept of the hippie speedball. We cover that. He breaks it all down. We're also going to talk about why it's so hard to plan for the future and why you shouldn't even be making plans 10 years out. You shouldn't even be making plans more than about 2 years out. We're going to talk about the science behind that and why you shouldn't be focused that far into the future. And we also talk about burnout. We're going to talk about some actual techniques and tactics that you can use to avoid burnout in your business and your life using some of this flow state concepts. So really, really good stuff, really impactful. Again, Joe and I have actually started using many of the exercises that he's talked about in this episode, maybe even done a few hippie speedballs here and there. Once or twice, maybe, can't confirm nor deny. You'll understand when we get to that portion of the episode. We're going to go talk to Stephen Kotler. Before we do, I want to give you a couple quick reminders. This episode was one that we took notes on back when we were taking Cliff's notes of every single episode. We're going to give those Cliff's notes away to you for free if you jump into our Discord. Go to hustleandflowchart.com/Discord and we'll hook you up with the entire Cliff's notes of this episode. Also, make sure you're following me and Joe on Twitter. I am Matt R. Wolf on Twitter. Joe is Joe Fear on Twitter. And follow the Hard Fork Media Twitter channel as well. We share a lot about Web3. We're really focused on crypto gaming, play to earn gaming, things like that over on our Hard Fork Media channel. If you follow me and Joe, Matt R. Wolf, Joe Fear, we're really posting a lot about business, marketing, Web3 topics, crypto, decentralized finance, a lot wider range of topics. So make sure you're following all three of those Twitter channels, because lots and lots of cool stuff is getting shared over there. And I'm just going to go ahead and stop now, and let's kick it over to Stephen Kotler.
Stephen, we're live. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you guys?
Doing amazing. It's great to see you. You know, we have a video of you now. We figured out the tech snafus with Zoom. Some of this exponential technology actually fixed video chat, especially during COVID. I mean, that would be nice.
But, well, oh well. I'm that's sure, okay. I'm sure that's what the 5G stuff that's in the works is going to fix for us. But
right, it is right. I mean, like, all we need is Elon to put up fast satellites faster.
Yeah.
I mean,
going pretty damn quick right now. It seems
they are going really quick.
It's like a launch day.
There's actually five, maybe six at this point, different orbital constellations going up, right? Including Google's Loon,
right?
Which they're launching, and you can now. So that's suborbital, and there's five going up above that. That's, you know, I mean, if they're talking about ubiquitous global 5G within a couple of years, and it looks like it.
It does. Yeah, 100%. And then probably on Mars too, way sooner than we thought too. It seems like all the countries, race.
That was next Thursday, right? Yeah. I got a text.
Right. Already have a reminder set up, make sure I'm there in time.
I got an alert.
That's right. All right. It's a fascinating time, man. And I think you're right in the middle, and it sounds like it's kind of engineered, but also obviously you had some background, you know, that got you to this point. Super fascinating. We've been looking forward to this conversation, and you're probably busier than ever too, I would assume, digesting all the information. How are things for you right now, actually, I feel like with COVID, a lot of us are thinking of flow states of the tech and all the changes happening.
Yeah, it's a funny time. The Flow Research Collective is literally busy. We're busier than we've ever been. We're absolutely operating at capacity completely across the boards, and we keep hiring people, which I think speaks to, one, the science around flow and around human peak performance, right? Our focus is on building the best science-based peak performance training in the world. And I think the, you know, group of 30 or 35 people who work with me to do this, I think we're best in the world. There may be organizations that are as good with different folks in those roles, but I'll take my team really on that one. And so crises in general are really phenomenal for training peak performance, right? Fear is ramped up. And when fear is ramped up, norepinephrine is ramped up. And norepinephrine is foundational to learning. It's the first thing, when information comes into the brain, goes into, you know, a couple of places and goes to the amygdala, which is our threat detector. But before it even gets there, the front end of the amygdala, what's known as the lateral amygdala, has a bunch of norepinephrine. And all it does is anything that shows up there, the brain has already determined, oh, this is interesting. I should tag it. I may want to learn it and remember it for later. Norepinephrine is that tag. That's heightened. The norepinephrine in our system is heightened during crises. It makes it easier to remember bad experiences, right? We all know this because we learn from bad experiences, but it also actually makes it easier for habit change. Charles Duhigg wrote a little bit about that in The Power of Habit. There's a really great time for that. And a lot of the work from home challenges, in a sense, that people are facing, they're phenomenal for creating a high flow lifestyle. You've been forcefully put into a situation that it may feel like chaos, but if we give you a handful of tools, and I really mean a handful of tools, you can actually start to sculpt it and really use it for peak performance. So it's a really good time for doing this work. And I think people are recognizing that. And on the other side, the work I do on the sort of exponential tech singularity, that side of it, you know, Peter Diamandis, who I co-wrote the new book, Futures Faster Than You Think with, we were in New York. In the day Faster launched was the day the news of COVID broke.
Oh my God.
So we're in New York, and all the TV people are trying to figure out what is this thing, right? We're ready. We were talking about it, I think, 3 minutes after it happened, right? Peter's a doctor,
yeah.
Right? So people want to ask him questions. And I remember looking at him, and we knew because a virus is an exponential, right? So we knew what was coming, maybe better than some of the other people. And I said, Peter, you know what this means for two-thirds of what we wrote about in our book? I was I think, you know, the future is faster than we thought, right? which is what happened, especially with, you know, certain healthcare, longevity, there's been explosions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And just with research alone, with the vaccine, I was actually talking to a doctor, not a vaccine type doctor, but he was like, typically it takes about 10 years from what I've found. And they're saying now by the end of the year,
I tell people this. This is, I was talking about this earlier on. I've been talking about it a lot, but I said that if you want to look at COVID, you got to look at three pandemics. You got the first one, which is the real pandemic. The second one, which was the pandemic of fear unleashed by it. Right. And we're still seeing that in various versions. And then you see the antidote pandemic, which is the pandemic of cooperation. Right. And in the beginning, this was nothing more than science going up in every freaking neighborhood in the world that said, need help, need vegetables, need anything. I'm your neighbor. Call me. Right. That was every neighborhood you could possibly go to. So we saw that. We also saw the science community, as you pointed out, cooperating science. You ever want to see what a true competitive environment looks like? Go to a science conference, right? Forget football, forget basketball, forget sport. Go to a freaking science conference. That's competition. So the fact that like scientists are sharing information, nations are sharing information, and the result, to get to your exact point, I don't know what the number is today. The last time I was checked was about 5 weeks ago, but there were 81 vaccines and cures already in trials.
Wow.
As you pointed out, it takes, you know, $1 to $7 billion on average to get something that far, you know, to get it into, you know, that end of the pipeline. And it's a 10-year developmental timetable in general. Now, it's funny because a lot of what keeps that really slow, like of all the things we're talking about in the book and in that book, healthcare is actually, and a challenge like COVID is fairly low-hanging fruit for where we are technologically. Mm. It's really interesting because we're having a global problem that you can make a good case for will be gone completely 15 years from now, 10 right. years from now, right? Like yeah. all the technology to surround this problem and get to it before it ever turns into a threat like this. Again, it's a question of scaling it up, but it's already here. And we're seeing that. This is the first display of that.
I love it. We just jumped to the deep end. This is the shit that we wanted, man, and expected too. Because like I think it was keeping me up at night. Just this, like, what happens after COVID? Like, no one's even thinking about that, really. Like, we're so consumed, like you just said.
I will tell you something that I think is interesting also about that I don't think anybody's pointing out. And I also want to say, before I say something interesting, I don't work on culture. Right. I work on the neurobiology of human peak performance. I write books. I run an animal sanctuary. Right. Like, I have really great knowledge on psychology, neuroscience, animals, and writing. That's my expertise. And then I expand into exponential technology. And that's the bandwidth. So I don't know shit about culture. I don't know shit about politics. But one of the things that I have noticed, because you can't do the work that I've done with Singularity University and Peter and without realizing that a lot of times when people talk about the gap between rich and poor, that's widening and widening. Now, there are millions of causes for that. And a lot of them are not what I'm talking about, but a huge chunk of that nobody is looking at is the fact that, and the reason the middle class is so gutted is it's not about a rich poor division. It's not about anything other than you can't keep up with technology. Mm. If you did not start to digitize your business in 1995, you have not kept up. And, you know, as a guy who works with a lot of companies all the time, I can, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Very few people, right? Unless you're in Silicon Valley or trying to work like that, you're not doing this, right? The entire middle class is a middle class that they prefer safety and security. That's the whole point of the middle class.
Sure.
You're conservative, you like to conserve tradition, you want, right? And as a result, you tend not to be early adopters for technology and you did not digitize your business. And as a result, you're incredibly vulnerable. And the middle class isn't going away, but the middle class that did not digitize is completely gone. And what is happening because of COVID is the middle class that has not really kept up with technology for 25 years suddenly has to. So everybody is digitizing their business, and we may, again, I know nothing about culture politics, is it right? Not my field, but what I'm starting to see is a lot of people figure out what people have already done this. Wow, it's actually remarkably easy to work from home. Wow, this technology is really great. Wow, if I create a digital product, I can make a million of them. And my cost is zero, right? Like, these are kind of foundational rules of doing business that way. And there's an entire middle class that is being forced to discover that. So one thing that I think is going to happen after COVID is we're going to see, the economy may wobble, all those things may happen, blah, blah, blah. But I think we're going to see a rebirth of the middle class because of this, because we've got a situation that is forcing my 80-year-old father to figure out, how do you use Zoom? How do you sell life insurance online, right? Like, all these things. He's 80 years old. He didn't want to, you know what I mean?
Like, no, he doesn't want to change now.
He didn't want to change. And I mean, he was 55 when all this started. He didn't want to change then, right? Like, I don't blame him.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's a lot of years. It's a long time. I get it. But suddenly, suddenly my mom is like, dude, texting is cool. I'm like, yeah.
You're like, not time, huh?
Yes, it is. Yes,
it did is. You figure out emojis
she,
yet?
She did. Dangerous. She got one of those customized emojis that sort of looks like it freaks me the fuck out. Oh, yeah. I don't even know what to tell her.
You don't want to tell her to stop. You know,
like, here's the weird thing. Uh-huh. Here's the weird thing. So my mother is a 78-year-old wonderful ancient Jewish woman. And she sent me this customized emoji. I have a friend who's going to go nameless here, but she's a 32-year-old. She always has sort of reminded me of my mother a little bit mm-hmm. in my dealings with her, but she's like 32 and she's got purple hair. And so my mother's emoji has silver hair, gray hair. This woman is sending me the same exact emoji, customized emoji that my mother is using. She's got purple hair. And there's like 40 years of, I don't even know what to say to them. I'm like, it's so creepy. I don't know what to do with it. It's really creepy.
Just maybe settle it in your mind. You're like, yeah,
I've been stalked by real stalkers before. That's frightening. Emoji stalkers, though. That's all. That's fucking next level.
Yeah. Think about the trolls on that one, huh?
Yeah, the emojis don't really convey age very well either. They're all kind of very universal.
Matt, what do you got over there?
No, I was going to make a comment about how I feel like the world like after COVID is going to feel very similar to that movie WALL-E, where everybody's like fat and in chairs and all the food and entertainment is just like being fed to them. Like, that's sort of my fear of what's going to be like afterwards, is because we're sort of getting used to like everything's coming to us now. Like the world got so easy for us to just sit in our house, sit in front of our screens and have all the shit just brought to us. And I'm a little worried about the consequences of that.
One thing for sure, all the technologies, right, on faster, there's a lot of like drone pizza delivery, right? Mm-hmm. Robotic pizza delivery, which is Domino's is involved in, but it's really being like rolled out in Europe already and blah, all that stuff, autonomous cars, all that, it's going so much faster, right? We're going to have drone delivery across. This is the craziest thing I've ever. Let me ask you a literally, I will give you any of my books signed, like a stack of them, if you can answer this. Uh-oh. Either of you. What country now leads the world in drones? Drone design, drone building, drone testing. Where is the hub of the drone universe right now?
Oh, it's obviously not somewhere that would be like the first to pop to mind.
I'm going
to
think, for some reason, I'm thinking Israel, but then I'm going to like Belarus, like some like really off, like some country. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. For some reason, the first thing that popped in my head was like South Africa or something like that.
Oh, you're getting very close. It's Rwanda.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Rwanda. Yeah. And the reason is they've got first of all, there's no roads. 50% of the country has no roads. So they need drones, right? Mm. So a lot of the drone companies that were testing drones for medical supply delivery and emergency supply delivery were testing in places like Haiti and Rwanda where there are no roads. There's no FAA.
Yeah, well, aren't they doing a lot of work in Africa to try to like prevent poachers through drones?
That's the other reason. That's the other reason. And there's no FAA, so there's no overflight regulation. You can fly the fuckers anywhere, right? So you can do all kinds of tests. So first of all, Africa skipped a whole generation in landlines, went right to cell phones. Yeah. Same thing with banking, right? They went right to e-banking. And now they're going right to drone delivery. Like they're bypassing roads, taxis, buses, trucks, all of it, and just jumping to drones. And I want to point out, by the way, when you talk about exponential entrepreneurship, that if I would have asked, the worst genocide in the world out post World War II, essentially, was Rwanda. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, if you want to talk about exponential entrepreneurship in dire conditions, right, like how it can work and what it can actually do. Holy crap. Mm. And the cool news, by the way, is the Virunga Mountains, which are in Rwanda and have the mountain gorillas and have been, their territory has been shrinking and it's been a huge problem. A lot of the drone money is being repurposed into environmental causes. And now Rwanda's national parks are some of the best in Africa.
So drones. You're getting
radical turnaround thanks to this stuff. So
yeah, post COVID, it's interesting.
Post COVID,
yeah, and what's cool with COVID? I would assume right now for the right perspective, and I think
it's always funny when you start a statement. What's cool with COVID?
Well, it's the constraints of it all. You know, it's like it's kind of the sounding of what I'm hearing you say is we're all constrained in some way, but it's up to us on how we use our constraints for better.
Yeah, and everything we know about creativity research, neuroscience of creativity research, innovation research. I've got a book coming out in January, my new book on, it's everything I've ever learned about peak performance. It's called The Art of Impossible. It's one book. Nice. There's obviously a lot of stuff on creativity. we know limits drive creativity, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Limits are phenomenal. In fact, nothing is worse than a blank page and, you know, no constraints, right? You're screwed. Every great creative flowering, the Renaissance took place during, you know, that crazy time of upheaval. Shakespeare was writing in between plagues.
Yeah, that's right.
people forget this, but like Shakespeare is what happened when they opened the theater after, like, right? Why did he write so many goddamn plays? Because the theater was closed for 3 years.
As a plague, he's been baking them. Right? Yeah.
Only thing to do, write plays and sleep with other people's wives. You can't write about it in your plays.
Yeah, it's apparently pretty fruitful.
Very creative period.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. But again, it's like, it's how you use it. You could veg out and just demand food all the time and not learn how to maybe cook your own damn food. And, you know, maybe, you know, some passion that you're trying to grow or skill, you know, don't veg out in front of the TV, of course. But so many entrepreneurs that we've worked with, like they've now, I feel like the good businesses have just gotten amazingly better, you know, exponentially better because they've kind of prepped themselves, like you said, since the 90s. But the other ones, it's quick to fall off right now, and it sucks.
Like, if you're like, I feel bad if you're in commercial real estate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you to do. You know what I mean? I've got like, get out.
You know, somehow heliports. Somehow. I mean, the heliports.
I mean, or start to, you know, be on the cutting edge of what is we have biosniffers. They exist. Uh-huh. I mean, this is not pie in the sky. We can sniff the air. We can sequence path it. You can build totally safe office buildings if these are your issues. We just haven't done it. Mm-hmm. So until that starts happening, that's a difficult business. For the people who are going to be on the cutting edge, what's the skyscraper of 2021? It's a whole new ballgame.
Could be 3D printed and, you know, even the construction company could be completely. Well,
that is the other thing, right? We talked about this in the book. There's this Chinese company who put up I'm going to get it wrong because I always think it's smaller than it was. It's something like 139-story skyscraper in 19 days. Yeah. They used modular construction and 3D printing, and they built, I want to say it was 2 stories a day or something like that. Maybe it was more, 10 stories a day. It was some unfathomable, you know what I mean? Like, you built a skyscraper in
19 days.
90 days. Like, less than a month. I've built that. I built an office once. I wanted to build something with my bare hands. So I built like a 700 square foot office with a friend of mine over a summer. It was a great office and I worked out of it for a long time. But it took like us 3 freaking months
to build.
You know, like all summer working 12-hour days, right? Just to,
hopefully you had some fun. Yeah, just to tick a box, right?
Yeah. I think when I read the book Bold, one of the most fascinating things that came out of that book for me was the potential for 3D printing for satellites, right? Like the ability to sort of like email a satellite to the ISS and then have them print it out and deploy it. Like, that shit is crazy. Yeah.
Maiden Space is already there, right? So like that was the difference. We introduced them in Bold, but in Faster, the freaking printer's up there and working.
Yeah.
And those micro swarm sats, are printable at this point. I guess I could see the words colonizing space out loud right now without seeing crazy anymore.
I don't think you're a weirdo anymore.
Like, yeah, for a long time, you couldn't say something like that because like everybody's just like, come shut up. And I'm like, no, man. Like, no, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
Like, whether there's
start with the moon, though. Maybe not Mars, but moon's a little bit.
It's going to be, there's really good cases to be made. And this is sort of Bezos's plan also, because he was influenced by the same guy, that you want to build space stations, huge space stations. You don't actually, planets are cause all kinds of problems. Obviously, space is not in the same category as science, neuroscience, animal, the things I know about it. I know about from space, I learned from Peter Diamandis. Mm-hmm. Though I did learn, somebody once taught me rocket science. They were like, I can teach you all of everything you need to know about rocket science in one sentence.
What?
And I was like, and it was a serious rocket. And I was like, okay, what is it? He's like, check it out. Big flame, small hole. Everything else is steering. I was like, Okay, yeah. You win. I got it.
Well, yeah, it's that and making sure the shit doesn't fall apart when you make the big flame go through the small hole. That's pretty much it.
Keep it together.
Yeah, and a whole team of people to Apollo 13 your shit from back home when it goes wrong. Yeah. And you've got like duct tape, a thumbtack, and a tic-tac.
Yeah. Right? What do I do now? Oh my god. All right, so I don't know how we got here, but I love it.
I'm not really letting you answer any of your questions. It's okay. I'm just
this is how we flow anyway. We just like to see where the conversation naturally goes. So we're
yeah, and I mean at the top of this, like, yeah, we have a bunch of entrepreneurs listening. They're gonna be fascinated. This is just humans should be fascinated with this kind of stuff that we're chatting about right now. But yeah, entrepreneurs in general, of course, you have the flow. You go so deep on flow. How long have you been in that space now?
I started working on it I was just talking to Andy Newberg, with my first mentor. He was at the University of Pennsylvania then, and he was a neuroscientist. And we were just talking about this. We think I called him in 99, which means I've been working on it for a year already or a little over. So since 97.
Wow.
I guess it's a while.
You don't need to do the math. It's cool. A while.
I'm not doing the math. Yeah. It's scaring me. 23 years.
Yeah.
23 years. The neuroscience has come so unbelievably far. I'll give you, here's the classic example. So one of the things that the neuroscience has enabled us to do is figure out where a flow state's coming from, what's causing them, what's triggering them. And as the downstream of that, and this is the work we do at the Flow Research Collective, how to train them. Mm-hmm. So if you go back to the 1990s, like flow, the original foundational work, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi did in the 60s and 70s, right? He wrote Beyond Boredom and Anxiety, which was his first book. I think it came out in 72, 74, whoa, 76. And it's, hold on.
For you listeners, he has a whole bookshelf behind him.
Yeah, sorry. I'm reaching and grabbing a book just so we know when this is.
Can you repeat his name? I've heard it before, but yeah.
It's Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. That was 75. So he must have started publishing that stuff in the late 60s, right? So in other words, this work has been around for a really long time, even to the 90s. And if you look into the data on it, where people could we train it using the psychology, which was very well advanced by that point, the hit rate was terrible, terrible, right? Best in the world at this stuff. And they had very, very, very little success. And what success they did have, they found they couldn't repeat it or anything else. Because of the neuroscience, right when I got involved, right, we had just done the first work on the first imaging study that looked at one of the phenomenons that show up in flow was just done. Where we've come to now, when you go through any of our training, right, our digital Dear to Dangerous training, we measure flow pre and post, and we're seeing on average a 70-80% boost in flow. This is, our kung fu is really good, but I've always say this, when you're talking about peak performance, there's no such thing as a hack. There's only one thing. There's getting your biology to work for you rather than against you. That's the only thing you can do. All this stuff, using the biology, you can get you. By the way, it's not always sustainable. There are problems. If you train up peak performers, they'll ever be able to get the 70-80% boost. What happens is most normal people have a substantial return to baseline. It has nothing to do with flow. It has to do with the flow massively amplifies the motivation triad of drive, grid, and goals, creativity, and learning. But if you don't have super solid foundations, like if your grit skills aren't really freaking dialed in and your intrinsic motivators, like if curiosity doesn't point to passion, doesn't point to purpose, doesn't, right? If it's not all lined up and stacked, if you don't know how to think creatively, right? If you haven't practiced divergent thinking, if you haven't practiced finding multiple solutions to problems, if you haven't learned how to think about things from, right? I could train up all the creativity in the freaking world in you, but if you don't have the skills, you don't have the skills.
Yeah.
Right. So what happens is where people wobble is not the flow stuff. That, because of the biology, we can really do something with that. It's these, and we have the biology on the other stuff too, but those tend to be the problems. The problem isn't around flow. Though if I give you a shit ton of flow and then sort of it cuts off because your grit skills aren't lined up, right? Yeah. For example, I've just given you a ton of crack cocaine and then taken it away cold turkey. And it's a miserable experience, right? It's why flow, this stuff, this work isn't for everybody.
It's, yeah, you know, that answered one of your questions, actually, I think. The synthetic way to get in a flow. Well, cry cocaine. Don't do that.
I mean, so we just, I will get, there is no synthetic way. And so two things on that. One, you guys may feel differently. And some people in this space get very offended with what I'm about to say, but I don't really care.
We offend our audience all the time. So,
okay. Yeah. So, when it comes to biohacking and pharmacological interventions, I always tell people, one, if you first look at a map of the human endocrine system, which looks like the New York subway system on acid, right? Whoa. Like it, trying to say input A is going to produce output B way down at the bottom of the chain is ridiculous under most circumstances. The only three nutraceuticals that ever work are caffeine, nicotine, and marijuana. Because we evolved with them. Mm-hmm. We evolved with these plants, right? So this is Michael Pollan's point in The Botany of Desire. We co-evolved with them. They can work with our system. Those are the performance enhancing chemicals that family that works. There's a couple other things you can sort of mimic caffeine with taurine and do a couple other things. But as a general rule, all the other stuff is sort of nonsense. And you're just being lied to so people can sell you shit.
But what about like microdosing psilocybin and things like that?
So I wrote about it in Stealing Fire. I personally am not a fan of microdosing. It makes me irritable. Does not boost creativity. Doesn't do anything. It makes my chest hurt and makes me irritable. So clearly not for everybody. Some people are getting astounding results.
Yeah.
Astounding results. I know more sober, successful, wildly successful entrepreneurs, people like familiar names in the business community who have been microdosing every day for years, right? I mean, it's astounding. And I don't that clearly seems to work for some people. I personally would prefer for the same thing, marijuana. I think marijuana is a better drug for creativity. And certainly if you're interested in flow, this is what you had Will on, right?
Mm-hmm, so
you probably talked about this.
Oh, hi. Yeah.
We know that, and there's 70 years of anecdotal evidence and starting to be actual real evidence because we're working on this at the collective. If you want a fake, the fastest fake flow you could get is to combine about 20 minutes of light exercise. So it gets quiet up here, right? That's technically exercise induced transient hypofrontality, front end of a flow state with, I used to say high-grade sativa. Mm-hmm. Now I say marijuana that's very high in terpenes, specifically limonene and a couple others that boost dopamine, right? Mm-hmm. That's really, and anandamide. Anandamide you'll get across the board from any strain, but what you're looking for is the anandamide coupled to the dopamine boost and a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Those three things, they call it, in action sports, they call it the hippie speedball, like they have for years, right? And action sport athletes have been using that combination, right? Let's do three warm-up runs on the hill. And we'll go in, we'll get a cup of coffee and we'll smoke a fatty and we'll go back, right? Cup of coffee and we'll on the chairlift, we're smoking the fatty. And people have been doing this for time immemorial. And, you know, there's a lot of neurobiology underneath it. It's not a one-way ticket. And it's not and there seem to be, besides the pharmacological work that we've been doing with Will and stuff like that, there seem to be, in science, there's a lot of what are psychologists call moderators, if-then conditions. So if goal seeking, for example, I'll give you one example. When you're setting high, hard goals, a higher goal is the mid-tier goal, right? You have your big, massively transformative purpose. This is, I want to save the world. Mm-hmm. And then your high, hard goal is, I want to save the world by writing great books and cooking great food, right? So a high, hard goal might go to cooking school or learn how to write a level, those kinds of high, hard goals.
Yeah.
For high, hard goals to be properly set, they have to be aligned with beliefs and values. Otherwise, simply because one of the goals, focus, attention, and anything that gives you focus for free is phenomenal, right? Because we burn a lot of our energy on focus. So goals, one of the things they do is they give us focus for free. But if it's not aligned with core beliefs and values, we're not going to pay as much attention to it, right? It's not us. So you can't really fake that shit at a biological level. You have to do it. So that's a moderator. I think one of the moderators that we're going to find around THC is if there's too much fear in the system, it doesn't seem to work. There's a woman who I work with, Heidi Williams, who works with the collective. At one point, she called me and she was looking at the endocannabinoid system. And she said, I have said for years that the endocannabinoid system promotes lateral thinking. Anandamide promotes the ability to find distant connections between ideas. And that is primarily based on the work done by an Italian guy named Greg Sammarini. A lot of people have tried to duplicate that since then. And no, it's hard to prove. Is it exactly lateral thinking? Is it something else? Blah, blah, blah. So there's something that I thought was true for sure and wrote about it in a bunch of my books may not be exactly true the way I unfortunately, that's the way science works. Right. But Heidi, she's like, dude, I think the reason anandamide is boosting creativity is nothing more than anandamide lowers fear. And it lowers, and we know this, like it directly works on the amygdala and it lowers. She's like, I think you're just less afraid to find wacky connections between ideas. And that's what happens. And it's not a bad answer. I don't know. My answer was, wow, that's really cool. Let's test that.
Like maybe. Yeah. Right?
How do we test that? That's a really cool idea. We haven't taken the next step, but it's a really interesting question. And maybe that's why marijuana boosts creativity. Maybe it's nothing more than like fear abatement. I think there's something more going on.
Yeah, because I mean, it could bring in factors like anxiety for the wrong reasons, well, potentially.
Or we also know, for example, a good mood. So one of the best ways to hack creativity is be in a good mood. And the reason is when you want to find alternative possibilities, the part of your brain that does that is the anterior cingulate cortex. And it can only do that if you feel safe and secure. If you're not safe and secure, it's going to look for immediate solutions to your problem. Right. Mm-hmm. If there's fear, cortisol, norepinephrine in the system, the ACC, whoa, no. We're going to be logical. We're going to be linear. We're going to solve this fucking issue. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you're totally safe and you don't have time constraints and your brain goes, oh, wow, I can just consider blah, blah, blah. Right. And that we don't think much of it, but we know, for example, all creatives, one of the things when they image the brains of eminent creatives, people who have had a lifetime of creativity, they find a number of different things. One of the things that they find is that the brains of creative brains exhibit what is called latent inhibition. If you're a psychologist, you call it latent inhibition. If you're a neuroscientist, you call it repetition suppression. Either way is, I'll give you an example. So if you suddenly move to San Francisco and you live at the base of Lombard Street, the first time you walk by and you look up and it's all crooked, you notice everything. Oh my God, look, it's so cool. The second time you look up, your brain actually, you get a diminished response. If I were to look, the first time neurons really fire. Second time, it's slightly diminished and your brain starts recreating some of it from memory and it doesn't give you all the fun. And by the fourth or fifth time, it's just the shit that's blurring in the background when you go in to get your coffee, right? Yeah. That's repetition suppression. So latent inhibition is when information comes into the brain, how long does it sit in your brain before you judge it, before you say it means this? Because the minute you say it means this, it can't mean that.
Yeah, you locked it into something.
So most people, it's really fast, right? People who have a long mindfulness practice, right? They get to slow that down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And in creative brains, you see it naturally slow down. This is why when you talk about beginner mind, right? When people say things like that, what they're really talking about is latent inhibition. That's the ability. Right. It's the ability not to determine this means this right away. And the brain is so fast, if you can delay it just a second in brain speed and in what connections, right? That's a massive amount of change. So that's one of the reasons mindfulness can boost creativity and blah blah blah. I don't have no idea how we got here.
I don't know, but that was one of the big starred things on my sheet here that I wanted, because I've heard you talk about this. A couple things. There's fear in there that came up. There's constraints, you said. There's mindfulness. Seriously, based off of my research on some of the latest things you've been doing, I noticed you're doubling down on mindfulness, things like breathing. And I've literally swiped what you said on a couple podcasts. I think it's like, okay, you know, 5 second inhale, 10 out, or ramp it up, 10 in, 20 out. That shit has done wonders for me just in the moment. Like, I've actually practiced it a little bit right here too. For the heck of it, you know, and it just makes you feel good. You think clear. So like,
I'll give you a faster one.
Do it. This is from
Dr. Andrew Neuberman. So if you try to look at the far corners of your eyes, like if you hold your fingers out to your side and try to see both of them at the same time, just do that and breathe and watch what it does to your nervous system. You got to try to see out the far edge of your eyes.
Yeah,
feel yourself like calming down.
In front of us.
Another peripheral vision calms your calms you down automatically. Mm-hmm. It activates the parasympathetic nervous system. You don't use your peripheral when you're under attack, when you're scared, you focus, it's laser focus, right? So the minute you go to peripheral vision, it activates the parasympathetic, the rest and relax system immediately. And it's the fastest way we know of to do that. Interesting thing also, when you're processing information peripherally, this seems to happen in flow also, right? If you've ever been in flow as an athlete, you tend to see a wider field of vision and right, it moves a lot slower.
They even say that too, a wider field of vision.
Yeah, exactly. It's because of this. And one of the interesting things is, and this is part of what happens in flow, when you're looking at things peripherally, you process information four times faster.
Whoa.
A lot of information processing takes place in the retina. People don't realize that, but your eyes are actually brain cells. Your eyes are part of your brain. They're just on the external side of it. They actually do information calculation. They're not passive in that way. They actually process a lot of data.
Wow.
Makes that's sense. Actually, and people, you say that and people think it's really mechanistic and it's really not like, or it sounds really highfalutin. It's not like how the brain works. It's really mechanistic. It's like filters. If there's this kind of light, it can pass through. If it's this kind of light, it can't pass through. Right? Like it's that mechanical. It's really, really basic at the level of the pattern recognition, but I have no idea how it got here.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you think about like the like real high speed, high danger sports. Like think of like a motocross or something like that. The rate at which they need to make decisions as they're moving around the track seems to need to be heightened.
Highlight. Freaking ball goes 200 miles an hour, right?
Scared the shit out of me.
Are you kidding me?
That's a good, very good point.
It's moving it twice as fast as a fastball from a major league pitcher, right?
I've done racquetball before and I scare the shit, against stepdad who was like basically a pro at the time. I'm like, okay, nope, I don't want to die.
Yeah, I don't give a shit that you're a beginner. Fuck you.
Pretty much. thank you.
You missed the operant term there, which was stepdad.
It's very true. No, we got there. I mean, there's something else that I thought was so fascinating is that the brain defaults to negative. And I think you said it's 9-1, maybe 6-1. It's like a range.
Yeah, that's, sure. I mean, I want to, it's about 9-1 is the research that Sean Aker did at Berkeley on this.
Okay.
Other people have looked at it, but it's really high. 6-1 is what happens if you have a daily gratitude practice. Mm-hmm. That's what a gratitude practice does.
So it drops the negative side. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because you're being thankful for things that are already true, right? Your brain doesn't have to wonder, I am really happy that I woke up this morning feeling healthy. It already happened. Mm-hmm. Like it's a done deal. My brain does. So your brain goes, the world is a little less dangerous. And so it can start letting in more positives, which as creativity is always recombinatory, you need novel information. So if you're tuned towards the negative, you may be staying safer, but you're not, creatively innovating, your learning rates are going, like so many things are going down. It's not that you want false, the power of positive thinking is actually that's kind of dumb. You want to be optimistic, but you want to be realistic and that you have to be both at once. And that's sort of the Kung Fu stance and the when you're trying to
like water,
you're trying to put it's lipstick on a pig and your brain notices. You can't lie to yourself, right? You can tell the whole world, you can bullshit the entire world, but we all know the little voice in your head is going, shut the fuck up, man. That's just not
that ego.
That's not your world, man. You're lying. Yeah. You're lying to them.
It's a lot easier too. It's like you don't have to make shit up. You're just like, think about what happened yesterday or this morning, like you said. Just be thankful at the little things and start stacking them, and you don't have to do the affirmations so much. I mean, if it works for you, I guess, cool. But that's almost future. Yeah, you're make-believe. You're kind of coming up with these not tangible things in the future. So, it's harder to trick your brain.
It doesn't work. I mean, right? Like it may work for visioneering works, but even that's difficult because the human brain has we have very limited time horizons. And there's specific, if you want to try to imagine 10 years in the future, there's specific techniques to use because our brain does not like to do it. It's very, very hard to plan that far in the future. I train people to have 2-year time horizons to think in 2-year increments. I think with today's technology pushing much beyond once you get past 3 years, I find it very hard to make any kind of real reliable prediction on anything. So I think
especially after reading your book, you know, what's happening. Yeah, it's even more so. Like, yeah. Well, I think he even said something. There was like, the further you get out, the less you're attached to like yourself. So you're actually
this part of your brain, the middle of your forehead, the medial prefrontal cortex, it does a lot of different stuff, but it does like creative self-expression. It helps us choose action plans and things along those lines. But when we think about ourselves, it gets really active. When we think about other people, it deactivates. And the farther away the other person is, you know, if you think about your mom, it's going to shut down a little bit. You think about, you know, a friend a little bit more. You think about that woman you met at the grocery store 2 weeks ago. It's almost right. If you think about your future self 5 years from now, it's almost totally shut off. Wow. Your brain treats the person you're going to become as an absolute stranger, which is why it's one of the reasons it's hard to plan for the future, hard to save for retirement, hard to get a prostate exam because just sign up, right? It's going to help future you, right?
Yeah, that's a good point, dudes. Yeah. Yeah.
As a guy who has to go get a colonoscopy next month.
Do it.
Yeah, we all kind of like aim for gratification now, but never really think of the preventative shit that's going to affect us in the future. So when it comes to like flow states, It feels like, at least from my perspective, you realize you were in flow after the fact, but you don't ever really kind of realize it in the middle of being in flow. So
there's a yes. And so it depends, right? Like think about baseball players, golfers, skiers, where like there's time in between the things. So a skier doesn't know you won't notice it on the hill. Mm-hmm. You'll notice it on the chairlift, right? For a writer, right? When I'm actually writing in it, I don't notice anything. Right. Mm-hmm. But when I pop up 5 minutes later for whatever, then I'll feel it and then I'll drop back in. Right. So you're right. And Martin Seligman, actually from the University of Pennsylvania, one of the godfathers of positive psychology, pointed out in, I think it's an Authentic Happiness. It's in the footnotes. He's talking about flow. And he said, you know, the interesting thing about flow is the state itself is emotionally neutral. Like it's everybody's favorite experience, but the experience itself is emotionally neutral. Emotions steer behavior. Flow is defined as optimal performance, right? Every action, every decision leads perfectly, effortlessly to the next. And you don't need to change behavior till you're doing everything right, right? So you don't need to modify behavior. So it's an affectively neutral state. And it's only on the back end. And there's an argument. I don't know if I agree with it or don't agree with it because I just don't think we know, but people have made the argument that on the very back end of a flow state, in that afterglow space you get, that there's people who have argued that it's serotonin. And we know you have a lot of dopamine on the front end of flow, and usually dopamine and serotonin are sort of antagonistic. They're not in the system at the same time, right? As a general rule. So you know you have a ton of dopamine on the front end, but it seems that peaceful afterglow is serotonin that shows up as the dopamine starts to fade. Flow is affectively neutral, and we think it's only if the serotonin shows up, that's maybe when more of the emotions start to show up. Mm-hmm. Is literally, that may be sort of part of it, but most of it is you're even, right? Your body sensation is gone. Your sense of self is gone. Everything's gone except the thing that you're doing.
So I'm curious, how do you actually like quantify flow for the sake of like researching it and studying it? Like,
it's a great question. So depends what level of scale you want to come in. Psychologists define flow, and have since Csikszentmihalyi, with six core phenomenological characteristics. So complete concentration in the present moment, time passing, time dilation, time passing strangely, self being diminished, the merger of action and awareness, so forth. So for what we do when we give you a psychological questionnaire is you've got a Leichhardt scale, 1 through 5, never to always. And how much did you feel your sense of self disappear, right? Those kinds of things. Now, that has its limit. It's proved remarkably robust over time, and it has really worked and led to a lot of breakthroughs. It's a little too soft and squishy for a lot of people, including us. Mm-hmm. So neurobiologically, there's an entirely different definition of flow. Neurobiologically, we are looking for things like deactivation of the prefrontal cortex, right? So less activity coming out of this part of the brain, except for this spot, which gets hyperactive. Mm-hmm. Everything else, especially over here, very, very quiet. Brain waves will move down to the alpha theta borderline. So if we're looking for that, we're looking for some combination of 5 neurochemicals. And now we're starting to get really good physiological data. So we know that, for example, cortisol, stress hormone, goes up. Doesn't shoot crazy high, but there's, it seems like, so at parasympathetic, sympathetic activation, when the body wants to really fine tune a process, it doesn't give you one or the other. It gives you both at once, right? So you can, right, you'll have a better, if I've got a shower in my bathroom, my office, that's got one knob for hot and cold. I've got two knobs in my house. Two knobs gives me more precise hot and cold than the freaking knob in my bathroom that I have to sort of stand there and adjust the whole time, right?
Right. Yeah.
So same thing with the brain. If you want to really fine tune something, you want both states at once, sort of, right? And that's what it seems that flow does. So you get, we know what some of your hormones are doing in flow. We know, though there's, we're doing some research to try to prove this again, but there's work that came out of the Karolinska Institute in Sweden that shows that your frowning muscles may be paralyzed in flow and your smile muscles may be hyperactive, right? There's a heart rate variability signature for flow, et cetera, et cetera. So we're getting it really down to the physiological. What we're doing at the collective, one of our is we're working on a device, a biophysical waste flow detector, that's going to combine two different sets of neurobiological signals with some physiological signals and be able to tell us. And just to give you an idea how fast this shit is moving, I would have said, forget us doing it. I would have said 10 years ago, this is not going to happen in my lifetime. I would have said 5 years ago, it was a long way off. I think we're a year away in our organization, and we're not the only people working with it. We're partnered with Adam Ghazali. He's at the University of California, San Francisco. He's got a whole research team that's taking a totally different approach to doing the same, right? There's like three or four, there's a team at the Platypus Institute doing the same thing. They're coming in through a different angle. Flow is a measurable biophysical neurobiological process in real time, is like a year and a half, 2 years away. I mean, I could be totally freaking wrong, because that's the way science can go, right? You think you're right there, and it turns out it's 20 years out.
You forgot, right? To look at this little detail.
So there's a great, the first artificial intelligence conference took place, I want to say in 69. I'm going to get it wrong.
Wow.
Marvin Minsky helped host it. And they literally, it was held at MIT, and they were like, oh yeah, we think we'll crack it over the course of a summer.
Wow. Right? Yeah, I don't know about that.
So is there a future where we have like wearables and we can like see like how long we spent in flow for the day?
Yeah, that's an interest. That's actually an interest. Yeah, perhaps. I don't see, people ask me crazy tech questions all the time. And I always tell people, I don't do substances and I don't do technology. And the main reason every time I say this out loud, I guess most people don't nearly die as often as I have nearly died.
Like, you've been through some interesting
about,
things.
I was just talking about this with a friend of mine who's a professional action sport athlete this weekend. And like, I say stuff out loud that most people think is outrageous. And to like the community I'm in, it's like, okay, that was Monday. Yeah. Right? But so I've been over the course of my journalism career, I was probably shot at 4 or 5 times. And at no time could I look at the guy wielding the gun and like, excuse me, sir, would you put that down until I use this brainwave entrainment device and we wait for the microdose to hit so I can dodge your bullets?
Yeah.
That shit just doesn't work that way.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, in my experience, the times you need peak performance the most are the times you have like the least access to a technology or a substance. Like when it's really, and so I'm interested in the psychological interventions that one work for everyone and are affordable for everyone. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pharmacological solutions and technological solutions are at least now, until the tech gets cheaper, they're cost prohibitive for certain communities. That's not interesting to me in general. I'd much rather, like, the biology works for everybody. Let's use that.
Yeah.
Right. It works in real, right. Like I'm much more interested in that approach.
Yeah. No. You and I were talking before we hit record earlier about how like now is the time to focus on flow and the stuff that you're passionate about. What was the context of that?
Yeah, there was something that you said about the primary and secondary states of flow. And then maybe after this, we could kind of start to wrap. But you were saying something that it's, your primary focus, our flow is...
Primary flow activity is secondary flow
to secondary
activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is just terminology we have. This is not standard you'll never find it in the scientific literature. We use it, the collective, to describe a phenomenon that we've just seen over and over and over and over again in people we work with, which is that everybody tends to have a primary flow activity which is usually that thing you did in your childhood that you just got lost in for fucking ever, mm-hmm. right? Like for me, it was skiing. For some people, it was dancing. For some people, it was, right? And, or it, if you don't make your, tend to make your living this way, later in life, it tends to be a creative activity. You play the guitar, you knit, you mm-hmm. like take your pick, right? Those kinds of activities, that's a primary flow activity. And the reason they're so important is, first of all, that when people get older and responsibilities start to happen, they're the first thing. It's the thing that goes.
Yeah.
It's the thing we cut, mm-hmm. right? And it's, from a performance standpoint, it is the literal worst thing you can do for performance. One reason is flow is a focusing skill, essentially. It's a specific way of focusing the brain. And the more flow you get, the brain's plastic. Mm-hmm. So the more flow you get, the more flow you get, right? If I get into flow a lot while surfing, right, mm-hmm. it translates literally the next mm. day yeah. into more flow in the office. We also know that this is Teresa Amabile's work at Harvard, but the flow, the heightened creativity you get in flow, different people have different numbers. We've tried to measure it a bunch. It's usually between 400 and 700% of an increase. It's a huge increase wow. in creativity, primarily in divergent thinking, but it lasts a day, sometimes two, after a flow state.
So that's the primary activity.
So if you go into your primary activity, you know, you're that heightened creativity and some of the heightened motivation and definitely the heightened peace, like the calm, it's going to persist for a little bit. So but it also is the focusing skill. And in times of crises, like if you want more flow in your life in the middle of COVID and everything else that's going on in the world right now, if it is available to you in a safe way, meaning like you're not going to go get COVID to do this, double down on your primary flow activity. Because if you're super nervous, you've got a lot of shit is scary. This is actually, it's going to be like putting on a familiar sweat jacket, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a really good thing. And then there's your second, and you also, I have found, try not to work in your primary flow activity. It'll ruin it. It'll just ruin it. It won't be as flowy and it won't be as fun. Then, like for me, writing is my secondary flow activity. I always say that, like, I go skiing. You have to usually have expert level skills for this to be true, but I've got expert level skills and I go skiing, and 95% of the time it's a flow state. Mm-hmm. There are usually two or three days a year that I don't get into any kind of flow state. And usually one is because I got in a fight with my wife, and the other two times are because I've been traveling for weeks on end and I just don't. I haven't stayed in shape. You know what I mean? I might, like, physiologically, I'm just not. I need to sleep. I need to eat. I need to, you know, recover a little bit, blah, blah, blah. But writing, 60 to 70% of the time, I get into flow when I'm writing, right? It's a secondary flow activity. Again, expert level skills, right? Because flow, it's an automatized process. So if you don't have the expert level skills, that's why learning matters so much. You've got to keep being able to do that. But
yeah, no, that makes so much sense too. Cause I know so many people that are like really high achievers in business, but they surf every morning, or they do jujitsu like 5 days a week. That kind of ties that together.
I will tell you. So this is something else we believe, and we're starting to get more and more data on this, but it's going to take long-term studies. Executive burnout, right? Which is really difficult for everybody. If you have a good active recovery protocol, not passive recovery, right? Not TV and a beer, but like saunas, massage, Epsom salt baths, light restorative yoga, breathing, right? All that active yoga, if you have an active recovery practice and you are pursuing your primary flow activity at least once a week, provided you're not in a work condition, the number one cause of burnout is like you work for a narcissist who is never going to like your work, mm-hmm. right? Because that's what narcissists do, yeah. right? So like as long as you can get sort of consistent and steady feedback, as long as that, this is a business that had to burnout proof your life. You will not burn out. If you have an active recovery protocol in place and a primary flow activity, we don't think you can burn out. Maybe you can, but it's as close to burnout proof as we can get you. And good God, is that a problem?
Oh man, yeah. Wow. Let's. I think we end it there because I think this is so much actionable stuff, man. And I mean, we can nerd out way longer, but we won't right now.
Yeah, we're approaching the hour mark right now. So we want to be respectful of your time. I'm sure we could ask you questions for another 3 hours, but
Yeah, well, something actually I think that you've said on some other places, but you have a flow blocker quiz that you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, Did you take it?
I did, and it freaking nailed it. And it was actually a few things I was already working on collectively.
Yeah. I haven't taken it yet. Joe pointed it to me right before we jumped on this call, so I'll do it after the call.
Yeah, for anybody who wants, we basically, there's been a lot of work done on kind of what are the biggest blockers for flow. We have a pretty good list. And then we added a bunch of our data. I think when we got to like the first 1,000 people we put through the course, I think we started to aggregate. That's when we started looking at this stuff or whatever. It was a while ago. So we found the 10 biggest it seems to be the 10 main flow blockers, and just built a diagnostic. It's flowresearchcollective.com/flowblocker.
Sweet.
And totally free. And yeah, it seems to be pretty damn effective for people.
It's not only that, but the follow-ups, we won't go into them, but flow channel. When you talked about flow channel, I think it was like first or second email. I was like, holy shit, this just makes sense. Like, especially as entrepreneurs, you're trying to achieve so much, but then basically the long and short, it seems like, oh, you just got to do like 4% better.
You got to do 4% better. And the other thing that I always tell people is if you're successful in anything, like I don't mean business, if you're good at anything at a really deep level, and by the way, if you're a good cat burglar, if you're a good gangster, this is probably true, right? Like
the full spectrum.
You had to get it. There's only the biology, right? There's nothing beyond the biology. So what we find is that when you start to train, like when people take our courses who are successful on whatever, often most of what we're doing is just showing them stuff they were already doing anyways and saying, here's the science and here's the framework. This is why you were doing these things. Here's how to do them a little more effective. Like that's right.
That's it.
As far as I can tell, though we're not going to, this is a teaser and then this is an awful thing to do to you guys. But as far as I can tell, what we really mean by peak performance is 6 or 7 things you have to do every day and about 6 things you have to do every week.
So it's going to be in the book, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, it's going to be in the book. And but some of them are like, some of them are no-brainers. Like you have to get a good night's sleep every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to hydration, nutrition. It doesn't have to be move fancy.
The body a little bit, endorphins. Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, we'll stop there. Yeah.
So awesome. the latest book right now is The Future is Faster Than You Think. Can you what's the name of the upcoming book that you're referring to?
The Art of Impossible.
The Art of Impossible. Awesome. Okay,
and it's coming out in January 15th. I think you can actually pre-order it now. I haven't seen it. Somebody told me the cover is up on Amazon and you can now pre-order it. I haven't gone to look.
We have great researchers on our team, so we'll just have them source it for us. I'm sure we'll find it.
But seriously, I don't think nothing says Merry Christmas like The Art of Impossible.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. All right, Stephen. Thank you so much for your time.
Guys, thank you.
Woo-wee. I had a fun ass time going back through and listening back and making some minor tweaks and edits to this episode. I'm telling you, this entire month, all of the episodes we've released this month, if you haven't listened to them, go back and listen to this is the 7th episode, but listen to all 8 episodes we put out this month because they are insanely impactful. Just going back and listening to them myself has been absolutely mind-blowing. Like, honestly, I'm so glad I got the opportunity to go back through and listen to them. I'm glad we decided to do this for this month because listening back to these episodes, all of it's rushing back to me. I'm getting just as excited as I did the first time I heard back through these episodes the first time. And the value inside of this content is so good. So check out our next episode next week. We're going to be having Victoria Song. I'm going to be bringing that episode back to the forefront and adding a little bit of commentary around that one. And that is going to wrap up our January recaps. And then starting in February, we're releasing new episodes, starting with a round 2 with Nick Peterson. After we released the replay of the Nick Peterson episode a couple weeks back, we got a ton of feedback that people loved that episode and they want to hear more from Nick. So we're going to be bringing Nick back on and he's going to be our first episode back. We're actually going to be live streaming it. So if you're in our Discord, we'll make sure you have all of the details about that live stream we're going to do with Nick, because that interview, you'll be able to interact with us. You'll be able to ask questions. We'll be most likely doing it live, barring any sort of technical issues that might come up between now and then. The plan is to do that one live. And then as far as Hustle and Flowchart goes, this show is actually going to scale back a little bit, back down to one episode a week. I believe they're going to be coming out every Tuesday, but don't quote me on that. That might change. We are going to be doing one episode a week of Hustle and Flowchart instead of two. But saying that, we're also developing a couple new shows over on the Hard Fork Media channel. So there is going to be a show about news and Web3 and what's going on in the world of Web3. We're going to start doing more episodes around crypto gaming and play to earn gaming. So lots of cool stuff in the works on the Hard Fork Media channel. And we're backing off Hustle and Flowchart to just one episode a week so that we can put focus on a second different show every week. So we'll still be doing two episodes a week, but one will be Hustle and Flowchart, our sort of deep dive interviews that you've come to know and love from the show, and then a new show that we're developing with our friend Crypto Buffalo about news and alpha and all sorts of cool stuff that's going on in the Web3 world. So that's a little sneak peek into what's coming. Before I wrap this show up, I just want to give you a couple quick reminders. Make sure you jump into the Discord. We'll hook you up with the entire Cliff's Notes of this episode if you want them. Just go to hustleandflowchart.com/Discord. Once you're in the Discord, go to the Downloads channel. We're loading all of the notes from these episodes and these recaps into the Downloads section there. So make sure you check that out. Join the Discord if you haven't already. And make sure you're following us on Twitter. I am Matt R. Wolf on Twitter. Joe is Joe Fear on Twitter. And then our Hard Fork Media is, well, Hard Fork Media over on Twitter. So go check out those Twitter channels. We're sharing a lot about what we're up to in the Web3 world. We're giving you little insights and details into some of the projects we're excited about and that we're actually investing in and things like that. So you can get early details on the stuff that we're finding valuable right now. And hopefully that's valuable to you. So make sure you're following us on the various Twitter accounts. That's really the only social medias we're hanging out on these days. We pop into Facebook and Instagram from time to time. But if you really want to interact with us, Twitter and Discord are the two main places to do it. And that's about it for this one. I will see you in a couple days when we drop our final recap episode of this month. See you then.